Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, George Mackay chats about a starring role in the new Joshua Oppenheimer movie, The End, as well as meeting his wife on the set of 1917. Chris Wasser reviews Novocaine, the movie about a reluctant, sort of, superhero, as well as the woman in the yard, and gives us the skinny on what was really going on with the new live-action Snow White movie. Plus, all the movies and TV shows you want to stream or skip. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well, and forgive me if you hear a little nasalness in my voice. I'm just attempting to get through a little cold that I have, a cold that I probably picked up on my recent trip to New York. Yes, not to bore you, but I spent a glorious 4 days with some pals in New York since the last time we spoke. I won't, go on telling you about my travels, but I'll just say, I've been many times, but I don't think there's any place in the world that is so utterly revisitable as New York. You can just go three blocks and there's something to see. And if there's, if you're a movie lover and a TV lover, the place is like a movie set. And there's so many places where you're like, oh, look, that's where Annie Hall was filmed, or that's where the restaurant in The Godfather is. It's just dripping in the place. And with music locations as well. I sat on the steps of the cover of the Billy Joel album, An Innocent Man, in Soho, and bored people with the photograph. But it's just a great, great city. It really is. I'll tell you what's not so great. A 5-hour plane delay. No one's fault. But we were on the plane on the way home, all in good time. We were literally, the nose of the plane was nearly in the air, and a light came on denoting some problem with a tire. So we went back, sat on the runway, and continued to sit there for 5 hours. Yes, so a 6-hour flight turned into 11 hours. Is there anything as oppressive as not being able to get off an airplane when you're dying to take off or just not to be there? I realize this is the zenith of a first world problem. But that was my week, and a glorious week it was too. But there is movie business in all this, because seeing as I spent so long in the plane, I did watch a lot of movies which happened to be on the in-flight entertainment. Now, we've probably talked about all of these, but I thought I'd give you a quick rundown again of some movies I watched that will be well worth your watching that are all now available on digital platforms. So Conclave. I'd already seen Conclave, this movie about electing a new pope with Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci. And I watched it again. That's how good it is. It's the mafiosa meets the Vatican, and the ending of it, by golly. So it is a fantastic watch, Conclave. It's available to watch on all digital platforms. You should definitely check it out if you haven't seen it. It would have been a worthy winner for Best Movie of the Year. A gripping, gripping drama. Stanley Tucci's terrific in it, as are all the main players in it. And a fantastic ending as well. And kind of about the future of the life of the church. Should it go backwards? Should it go forwards? A great watch. Chris Wasser reviewed Wolves on Apple TV a couple of months ago, where George Clooney and Brad Pitt play competing hitmen, hitmen's the wrong thing, although they do take people out if needs be, but they're fixers. They show up at scenes and get things done, like the Wolf character from Pulp Fiction all those years ago, played brilliantly by Harvey Keitel. There's two of them in this. They both show up mistakenly somewhat to a kind of crime scene where there's a prostitute involved. It's a pretty good watch. Chris Wasser gave it 3 stars. Maybe not 4, but a very entertaining watch. Set in New York, one night where these two hitmen have to begrudgingly become friends, even though they're rivals. So that's Wolves, W-O-L-F-S, if you know what I mean. Well, that's how it's spelled. Of course you know what I mean. On Apple TV, well worth a watch. A movie from back in September, which is now on Netflix, but was also on my in-flight entertainment, was The Outrun, starring Saoirse Ronan, which is all about, it's based on a book by Amy Limtrot, I believe her name is, about her childhood in the Orkney Islands off the coast of Scotland, very remote. She had a strange childhood whose father was in and out of a mental health facility. And she moves to London and alcoholism takes over her life. And this movie shows her life in London and also her attempt to return to some kind of normality and find peace on the Orkney Islands, living at times in a very cold, desolate, but ruggedly beautiful place. And Saoirse Ronan is mesmerizing in it. So that was another recommendation. As I say, we reviewed most of these movies last year, but I rewatched them on a plane. So I just want to tell you again, if you're looking for something to watch this weekend, because they're all available on digital platforms, The Outrun is now currently streaming on Netflix. Well worth your time. Saoirse Ronan is 5 stars in it. And finally, a real nice movie called We Live in Time, I also watched in the plane, starring Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh as two people who come together when she runs him over in a car accident and he wakes up and she's waiting there and they fall in love and they move around their relationship in a kind of Annie Hall kind of way, the way the narrative moves around. A very affecting love story about sticking it out together and illness coming into a relationship and that kind of thing. So We Live in Time, now available on Prime for your streaming pleasure. So there's 4 recommendations for you if you're looking for something to watch this weekend. All of these would have been reviewed, but I watched them again on an airplane. So I thought I'd let you know about them. Now, to the business at hand, in TV this week, I was watching this.
Right now is a steak dinner. There are 200 people down there, including the President of the United States.
Did anything unusual happen?
Other than my boss dying?
Other than that, yes.
That's Cordelia Cuff.
She is the best detective in the world.
Where's the body? Oh, I see feet.
Mr. President, this house needs to be treated like a crime scene. There may be a murderer out there.
Who's he?
Edwin Park, Special Agent, FBI. I'm really just here to help.
And you had one, that would help.
Yes, that's a clip from The Residence, a new series you may have heard about. It launched last week on Netflix. 8 parts. As you heard there, it's very much a whodunit. Starring Uzo Adaba, who's known for her portrayal as Crazy Eyes in Orange is the New Black. She's brilliant in that. She's brilliant in this because she plays this very funny detective. Cordelia Cupp, brilliant detective. They say the best in the world. She's a keen bird watcher and sardine eater. And she's called in to investigate the death of the White House's chief usher. So all of this takes place in the White House, in its 132 rooms. His body's found in the private quarters of the presidential building, while a state dinner designed to repair fracturing relationships with Australia is unfolding below. And then on top of this, we have all the advisors, the director of the FBI and the Secret Service who come in and are kind of furious because she's not going to let anyone leave the building. There's a whole funny kind of Australian thing going on. Kylie Minogue has a great cameo in it as well. And this is obviously a whodunit, and it's very much like, you know, Knives Out. And they make direct references to that. And an episode is even called Knives Out. And there's an Agatha Christie vibe as well. This is from Shonda Rhimes, the person behind Bridgerton and all sorts of things like that. And has a, you know, there's a high production value here. This is very, very entertaining, fun. You know, it's not really making huge comments about American society. Well, maybe it is on some level, but it's not about that. It's entertaining in the way Knives Out is entertaining, and it wears its references very much on its sleeves. Sleeves, plural, on its sleeve. I mean, you can wear it on both sleeves, I guess. But this is really fun TV that would be a nice bam for you if you're looking for something again this weekend to watch. That's, you know, just going to give you pure gleeful escapism. I think this, even though there's a murder in it, it's a murder in the kind of oh, look, somebody's been murdered, even though it's American and Australian. But very, very entertaining. This is The Residence on Netflix. I've watched 3 episodes, so it's 8 parts. But rumor has it, it stays good till the end. So if you like Knives Out, Agatha Christie, you'll really enjoy this. And as I say, high production values, very well acted. So that's The Residence. A big thumbs up from me for just a good old fashioned, entertaining watch, now streaming on Netflix. Let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I've been talking a lot there. We better let Chris Wasser in after the break and tell us about the week's new cinema releases. Now you're listening to Screen Time. We turn to the week's new cinema releases on the big screen. Chief among them is an interesting movie called Novocaine, all about a man who has a superpower, but not really, played by the son of one of the famous father, anyway, Jack McQuaid. And there's also a son of Jack Nicholson in it, and a strange horror of sorts called The Woman in the Yard, starring Danielle Deadwyler. To make sense of all this, I'm joined by regular movie critic and arts journalist on this show, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello, sir.
John, how are you?
Very well. So listen, Novocaine, I've seen this, but more importantly, you have. The premise is a guy has a real life condition where he can't feel pain even though he is injured.
That's right. Yeah, it's an extremely rare but also very real genetic disorder that means that the character in this film and also people in real life, they can't feel any pain. And it's sort of one of those unimaginable disorders where when you're actually watching the film and you're watching all of the precautions that the character takes, the film is actually very good at setting this up. You're thinking to yourself, oh, so does that mean that taste, or, you know, like when he touches that doorknob, or yeah, when he's making the coffee, like how does that affect your life in a huge way, apparently. So we're introduced to this character, Nathan Kane, or as the bullies at school used to call him, Novocaine. And various characters in this film, John, point out that, you know, that's actually not a bad nickname. Could be quite cool.
Yeah.
Who lives in Marshall.
I've been called worse than given.
I've definitely been called worse, John. But he lives a more sheltered life than others. But he is, and what I mean by that is, like, he's sort of had to have made his house, like, he has no children, but it's almost a child safe zone because he can't feel any pain. So this affects how he eats. He can only, you know, eat, he's on a liquid based diet. He has to have, you know, ice in his coffee. He has to have sort of like cushions on every corner in case he falls, and he also has to set a timer on his watch, you know, just to remind them to use the loo or your bladder will explode. At work then, he's doing quite well. He's an assistant bank manager, but he's a little bit distracted in the run-up to Christmas because there is a charming clerk whose name is Sherry, played by an excellent Amber Midthunder, who has caught his eye. And let's face it, he's head over heels for her, and the feeling might actually be mutual. And after having this amazing first date with Sherry, you know, Nathan is starting to think that, you know, his life might take a turn. You know, he might actually be happy for once. Unfortunately, that also coincides with a bank robbery in which a trio of opportunistic criminals, all dressed like Santa Claus because this is Christmas week, they rob the bank. They you know, injure and kill some people, and they also make off with Sherry. So Nathan is facing, you know, he's looking at a kidnapping. He's thinking, what can I do here? I'm not a superhero. But does that stop him from trying to save the day? It does not.
No. And we've got kind of that reluctant superhero vibe, like The Greatest American Hero or Shazam or whatever, which can be quite pleasant, I find. Jack Quaid, I thought, is pretty good as that somewhat hapless superhero of sorts.
He is. He's a very charming actor. I am not all that familiar with The Boys, but I'm more familiar with his film work. And this is actually the second film that we've seen him in 2025. And I thought he was quite impressive playing...
The Boys, sorry, you're referring to the TV show.
The Boys, a TV show, yes, on Prime Video. But the film work that he's done, I've been quite impressed with. Companion, which I thought was sort of an overlooked and underpraised tech horror in which he played an altogether nastier character. But here he's playing someone with a bit more charm, and that actually comes very easily to him. And I thought Amber Midthunder, who we saw in Prey before, works very well in this too. And the both of them work extremely well together. And I've seen a couple of people refer to, you know, the more romantic comedy elements in this film. Some people calling it a romantic comedy, and it's not quite that. It's more of an action comedy, and it's kind of sometimes fancies itself as a superhero film, as you mentioned. But the two of those actors would work very well in a romantic comedy together. They do have a lovely chemistry. This is also, John, one of those action comedies that sort of sees, you know, ordinary man thrust into extraordinary circumstances and like doing things that nobody like Nathan should be able to do. I mean, I had so many questions. I just kept thinking to myself, fair enough, he can't feel any pain. If he goes after the bank robbers and he gets into all of these gruesome, gory, vicious fights, it's one thing taking, you know, 100 knocks to the head and getting back up and the bad guy's being like, how come this guy is not dead at this point? It's another to fight the way that Nathan can fight. So you might be thinking to yourself, where did he learn all of that? I think the film sometimes expects you to believe that he picked it up in video games. Fair enough. So some of the storytelling, you know, is a bit flimsy. There are a lot of plot holes, but I did have fun with it.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think an awful lot of that is down to Jack Quaid. I mean, he's fully committed. He's enthusiastic. You know, he's in on the joke. It is sort of, you know, there is only one big joke here. There is one idea here. And the directors, Dan Burke and Robert Olsen, they are certainly making the most of it. You know, it may be, you know, it could have done with a handful of other good ideas. But again, you know, it doesn't try to be anything other than what it is, which is this ridiculous, cartoonish, bone-crunching action comedy. And I think it sort of delivers.
Yeah, no, I agree with you for the most part. And I think you're also saying, though, but it is a one-trick pony nonetheless. But it's pleasing. Yeah. It's a pleasing enough one-trick pony. And I agree with you about the chemistry between the two leads. Quite pleasant. The whole idea of it being set at Christmas was completely wasted, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's so half-hearted in the Christmas setting. And the first time I saw that it was set at Christmas was a Christmas tree in the background of the bank where Nathan works. And I thought, oh, okay, it's Christmas. And then the cops are making some sort of joke about how, you know, they thought that their Christmas Eve was going to be easy. One of them wants to get home to watch It's a Wonderful Life. It's like, okay, commit to this thing, guys. Yeah. You know, and at no point do we ever see any other Christmas decorations in the San Diego setting. So I'm wondering what happened there, why it was set at Christmas. Maybe it was originally, I'm just guessing here, but maybe it was originally supposed to have a December release. And now that it's been kicked into spring, maybe some Christmas elements have been removed, but they couldn't remove everything. I don't know. But then that's just one of the plot holes that I was mentioning. Why is it set then? We don't know. It is a bit of a one-trick pony. The joke does eventually wear thin. There are some elements that are a bit underused in it. I'm saying Admiral Midthunder is great. I do wish he was in it a bit more. Yeah. And also Jacob Batalon from the Spider-Man films with Tom Holland, he's in it here. But again, he's playing, John, the goofy, screwball sidekick role. Yes. And it's like we've seen him do that. And I kind of wish the film would give him more to do.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you in nearly all of that. And the baddies are a bit undercooked, aren't they?
They are a bit undercooked. So we've got bank robbers dressed as, all of them dressed as Santa Claus, who work in a garage. And I won't say any more because I might spoil the whole setup. But the chief baddie is played by Ray Nicholson. So that means that you have this unusual situation, John, where the goody in the film, Jack Quaid, is a nepo baby, has some very famous parents, Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid. And the baddie in the film is also a nepo baby because Ray Nicholson is the son of Jack Nicholson. But I had this unusual situation of my own where the whole time I was watching it, John, I thought, he looks like somebody. He has somebody's smile and somebody's eyes, and I just can't tell who it was. It was only afterwards that I thought, oh, you're Jack's Yonfla. Is he as good an actor as his dad? I'm not quite sure, but I think it's more the writing that lets him down because they're fairly standard villains. It's not about the villains. It's all about the hero.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, the stuff about him feeling the pain and all, even though there are plot holes with that, he's believable doing that, I found, in terms of I can't feel this. Oh, I'm pretending to feel it at times and stuff like that. So I'm almost in complete agreement with you about everything you said about Novocaine, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 28th of March. What are you going to say stars-wise?
Yeah, look, I think it certainly puts Jack Quaid through the ringer, and in turn, it puts its audience through the ringer. So, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. There are some queasy moments in this film. And I think the first hour is the best. It all starts to get a bit repetitive. It sags a bit in its final third. But I had fun with it for a while. So we'll say 3 stars.
Yeah, 3 stars seems about fair. Let's take a quick clip of Novocaine.
Why don't you just call the police?
You think I'm in on this?
Manslaughter, grand theft auto.
Do you know what it's like to wait your whole life to meet someone? Someone who finally gives your life meaning? Would you wait around for someone else to save her? Or would you do it yourself?
That's a clip there from Novocaine, which Chris Wasser, and for what it's worth, I also gave 3 stars to. Something very different is The Woman in the Yard, starring Danielle Deadwyler, who was in a movie that I adored, is probably the wrong word, but her performance in a movie called Till from 2 years ago, where she plays the mother of the very tragically murdered in the 1950s, if not 60s, forgive me if I'm getting my dates wrong, a young boy by the name of Till. She's brilliant in that, and that's my outstanding memory of her. This is something very different, though.
This is something very different. And I am with you on Danielle Deadwyler. I think she is an extraordinary talent. I thought she was brilliant until the film around her wasn't always. It sort of had a TV film of the week vibe, if I recall. But the performance was so good that I was actually astonished when she wasn't nominated for an Oscar.
It was astonishing. I remember on this show saying that's a definite Oscar nomination. And she had been nominated for other awards in the run-up to season. But anyway, let's go on to The Woman in the Yard.
The Woman in the Yard, it does exactly what it says on the title, John. So we are in Blumhouse horror territory, because Jason Blum, anytime we see a major studio horror now, if Jason Blum's name is not attached, I am amazed. But it's a great setup. So you have Deadwyler playing a woman named Ramona, who has just has been having an awful time. She is a grieving widow with 2 children. They live in a rural, in a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. And we'll learn as the film goes on that Ramona's husband, played in flashbacks by Russell Hornsby, died in a road accident, and it seems Ramona might have been in the car with him at the time, because she is sporting a nasty leg injury, and also she's fallen into this deep depression. She can't get out of bed in the morning. She has 2 kids. One of them is a teenager who is essentially looking after the other kid, but one morning they have to get their mom out of bed. There's no power in the house. They need her to get up and ring the electrical company, but then they discover, as you know, this always happens in these kinds of films, their phones are dead. How do they charge their phones? They can't. So they try and just go about their day, hoping that the power will go on. But then something very strange happens. An anonymous stranger, shrouded completely in black, appears outside the house, in their yard, on their property. And she's sitting in a chair. They're asking themselves questions of, where did she get the chair? Where did she come from? Who is she? Why is she here? They go out and they ask all of these questions, John. But the stranger, the woman in the yard, won't give any answers. All she really says is, today's the day. And okay, we don't know what that means. Ramona doesn't know what that means. And so what they decide to do is lock all the doors, stay in the house, and hope to God that everything will be okay. I probably don't need to tell you that everything will not be okay.
Yeah, I can imagine. And sorry, who's the woman played by? The titular
woman in the yard, yes. So eventually we will see her face. I don't think that's giving too much away. Okay. But she is played by an actress named Okwia Opakwasili, a wonderful actress who, again, spends half of the film, you know, with basically a cloak over her face.
Okay, right. And there's, I suppose, part of the thing is you don't see her for a long time. Yeah. So I'm sensing this is just terribly obvious stuff that didn't scare you.
Terribly obvious stuff, but I will say that's a tasty premise. And, you know, between the title, the front woman, Danielle Deadwyler, and the setup, which sounds like something from a spooky Stephen King short, and yeah, I love those kinds of things, I was all in. And I was disappointed then, about 15, 20, 25 minutes in, it becomes very, very clear, John, that nobody involved in this thing knows what to do next. They have the setup. And they have, you know, this wonder that there's so much potential here to frighten and unnerve and really, you know, just like make the audience feel uncomfortable, which is, you know, essentially what you want with these kinds of films. They just don't know how to do it. And it just starts talking itself to death. It starts offering up these messy explanations. It starts offering these weird allusions to the mirror has 2 faces. Probably not the Barbra Streisand one, but I didn't quite guess why it was doing that. And I think that's the central thing here. There comes a point in this film where you start wondering if you've dozed off, because it gets very, very confusing. It starts doing all of these weird, you know, is this a dream? No. Is this an imaginary thing? Is this really happening? And it never really... It just doesn't really know what it's doing. And I was so confused. I was so frustrated. It's just, it's an awful waste of an awesome setup, basically.
Oh dear. Yeah, when you're saying did I fall asleep during the movie, that's not good. Okay, we probably don't need to spend a huge amount of more time on it then. So it started well, you were all in.
Yeah.
Then it falls off a cliff because they clearly didn't write a script that made any sense. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Woman in the Yard?
Yeah, and it's also suspiciously short. You know I like a short film, but if something is 80-odd minutes, I'm beginning to think something got cut.
Great too stuff. Short for Chris.
Yeah. Too short for me, John. Great stuff from Danielle Deadwyler. She is fully committed. She never gives up, even when the film around her is completely just collapsing in on itself. Yeah. But she deserves better, so I have to go with 2 stars.
2 stars for The Woman in the Yard. Now listen, before I let you go, we didn't get to it last week, what with my conversations with my good friend Robert De Niro and Orwin Winkler, not to mention Francois Ozon. It was a busy show last week, and some of the cast from Adolescence. But Snow White, the live action remake, I know you've seen it. It has been getting awfully bad reviews.
Yeah.
A live action remake, is it as bad as people are saying?
It is, I think. I will say this. Look, Rachel Zegler is not the worst thing about this film, because there was an awful lot of, unnecessary conversations around her casting. Some of them quite ridiculous. Some of them just downright racist.
Yes.
But she is very good in this thing. And she's kind of the only cast member who's capable of kind of really delivering those old school showstoppers, the kind of thing that, a live action musical requires. So she we'll push her aside. Everything around her, a complete mess. I think the attempt to blend the new and the old, you've got these contemporary songs which sound like, songs from every other contemporary big screen musical at the minute.
Yeah.
Throw them in with Hi Ho and Whistle While You Work. It just doesn't sit right. It sounds like two films sort of competing for your attention. I wasn't all that fond of Andrew Burnett's performance. I think he's a little bit, he's kind of like Kerry from the Princess Brides, basically minus the wit and the charisma. So that's not great. I thought the decision to to give these CGI versions that resemble the cartoon versions of the Seven Dwarfs, it was baffling because they are so dead-eyed. I can't imagine that you had executives, that you had people at Disney watching a final cut of this film and saying, oh yeah, we're happy with how the dwarfs look. No, if you've made such an attempt to have everything else in the film live action, then to have all of these characters remaining as cartoons and just not very particular, not effective cartoons, I don't think it's good enough. But I think worst of all, John, saving the worst to last, is
there's more, folks.
There's more. Gal Gadot's performance as the wicked stepmother, it is irredeemably awful. It's just there are so many talented actors who could have played that part better. I think this really kind of shows her, and I loved her as Wonder Woman to begin with, I think in this she has neither the charisma, the presence, the range, or even at times it looks like she hasn't got the interest in kind of making that role fun. And it needs to be fun, John, because that's Disney's first cartoon villain there. That's such an iconic turn, and you need to just go over the top with it. And disinterested, that's how I describe it, and it's not good enough. So I do you asked, I gave you a very long answer there. You asked, is it as bad as everyone is making it out to be? It's kind of worse.
Ooh, are we talking 1 star?
I'll stick with 2. I'll give 2 stars for Rachel Zegler's performance.
Okay.
And the other star because it ended eventually.
Yeah, okay. And I also have to say to you, because we haven't spoken in a couple of weeks, but on the record, you got it right about Anora winning Best Picture. So you were right. I was wrong. I said it was going to be The Brutalist. You said it was going to be Anora, and you were proved right. So, live in that.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, people don't say that to me often enough, so I'm gonna enjoy that.
I hear you. Okay, but for this week, we are saying Novocaine. It's probably worth cinema's admission of whatever it costs these days. Chris and I don't pay. We're showbiz. I'm joking, of course. That's 3 stars for Novocaine, 2, and it sounds like it could be being generous for The Woman in the Yard, and a very generous 2. I haven't seen it, but Chris has. I don't think the review meets the star marking for last week's live action remake of Snow White, but 5 stars for his predictions for the Oscars. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Up next, actor George MacKay on his role in the strange new Joshua Oppenheimer movie, The End. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. Now take a listen to this.
See how I shine, the best comes last in the grand design, and I'm unsurpassed. at. The future's mine alone. The shining city on the hill is me alone, alone. Who else to light the way but me alone, all alone. I am here to keep the dark at bay. Oh God! Don't you dare start crying. Stay strong, and you feel like you're flying.
Now that was from a musical of sorts. That was George Mackay. Well, it is a musical. The great George Mackay from 1917 in a new movie called The End from Joshua Oppenheimer. Joshua Oppenheimer gave us a pair of documentaries, which are two of the greatest documentaries ever made. The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. The Act of Killing was Oscar nominated, as was The Look of Silence. And they deal with the mass killings in Indonesia in the mid-60s and a kind of reenactment of those with the people involved. If you've ever seen it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And Joshua Oppenheimer has now returned with his first feature. And it is a very strange movie that, as I say, is a musical and takes place in a kind of post-apocalyptic world. 25 years after an environmental collapse that left the Earth uninhabitable, one family clings to a sense of normalcy while confined to a palatial bunker and a kind of salt mine. We have a wealthy ex-ballerina mother, played by Tilda Swinton, and a former oil executive father, played by Michael Shannon, and their precocious son, played by the aforementioned George Mackay, who keep a kind of happy routine, and they have some of their previous staff with them as well. But when a girl turns up at their underground doorstep with her own past and a kind of plain spoken perspective on things, the group's blind optimism begins to unravel as long repressed emotions resurface and a connection blossoms between this new person and George Mackay's character. And some of the things he thought he knew about his father slowly start to unravel, let's say. So this is a very strange film. It's dividing critics. It's getting 5 stars and other people are saying, what's the point? But there is a lot to recommend this. And not least of all is the brilliant young actor. Well, he's mid-30s. That's young. George Mackay, who I spoke to before for the Netflix movie I Came By. He was in the Proclaimers musical movie Sunshine on Leith, but most people know him for his brilliant role as one of those running soldiers in the great 1917, a fantastic movie. So I spoke to George earlier in the week about his role in Joshua Oppenheimer's The End and a bit more besides. So, George, you know, I have to ask, you started this, you're painting what looks like a train set, you start singing. You know, my immediate thought is we're not in Kansas anymore, we're in a bunker in some possibly post-apocalyptic world. You must have got this and thought, wow, I haven't done anything like this before.
Yeah, it was certainly probably the most unique script I've received. It was, I think it's beautifully sort of bizarre, the whole thing. Mm. But that said, the kind of the strangeness of it is kind of was always like baked into the idea. You know, the fact that it was a musical was a very clear and precise thematic choice from Josh, our director, who, you know, so it wasn't just kind of trying to throw things together for the sake of it to try and do something a bit different. It was all very thought out. And the kind of irony was that with all of that precision and forensic thought, something quite, you know, strange comes out of it.
It certainly does. And we'll get to the movie itself, but just the singing, you did a great job, but there weren't singing lessons involved or anything like that.
Oh God. Yeah. Months and months.
Okay. Like,
yeah. I knew about the film for a long time before we actually came to shoot it. Like there was a period of time where the kind of the team was being assembled and the finances were being put together. And because I knew there was so much singing and I had heard songs that we would be singing beforehand, I kind of used all of that time just to practice, basically.
Okay. Well, look, it paid off. So, you know, it's very intense. And I mean that as a compliment. And you're in this bunker. And I don't want to give too much away because it reveals itself. But was it an intense being in that kind of chamber piece as an actor with those people for presumably a long period of time?
Yeah, it was. Like, I think... It was in two ways, in terms of it was a very kind of rigorous shoot in terms of, hopefully you don't really realize it, but there's so much about the film that is so kind of beautifully choreographed, you know, be it the movement within the songs, but also the structure of the dialogue and the scenes themselves. Like it's, I kind of used to think of it like sort of like Tweed or something, you know, like patterns upon patterns upon patterns to make a pattern.
Yeah.
And you sort of had to know all of those steps because they were, you couldn't divert from them too much because one thing sort of informed something else, which happened way down the line in the story or in the film. And then, or one musical note is then repeated by another character at another point. So you kind of couldn't, we discussed it a lot so that we were happy with the kind of quite strict steps that were in front of us that, that we, when we came to do it. Mm-hmm. But once we were there, that was something that was, that had its own intensity, having to be so precise in it.
Yeah.
And of course, it's also about, it's about telling the truth. You know, it's, it's a film. It's all about honesty and the ramifications of those, you know, when you sort of little white lies or perhaps massive lies into some of the characters in the family. Like, but it was, you know, when you're forensically exploring a group of people or playing a group of people who are under the microscope about being truthful all the time, it sort of leaves you nowhere in your own life to go. You can't let anything slide, you know, let all of those, I'll just let that one go. It, so it was kind of that in itself, in a very healthy way, has, but was sort of intense, I guess.
And so does that mean, and I don't want to Dr. Freud it, but from what you're saying, was it cathartic for you, the making of this, in that you felt you weren't going to maybe, you know, let things slide or engage in white lies? And I don't want to pry too much, but did the movie have that effect that you re-entered your own life feeling, I'm going to cut the SH1T?
Yeah, you always, I think the best thing with any job is that, you know, you take the lessons that that are healthy from it, either from the character or for the stuff that you've studied, be it, you know, it can be anything, like the history that you're looking at. But with this, yeah, definitely moving forwards. And there wasn't like, you know, one particular thing, but just in the sharing of the film and everything afterwards, you kind of have to put your money where your mouth is in terms of you're making a film about honesty and even in the talking of it.
Yeah.
Like just not, not being false, basically. Mm-hmm. And but that said, again, the film is, there's a beautiful nuance because it's exploring kind of when you can do that and when you can't. And it's the same thing like promoting this film. Ultimately, it's a film about climate change in so many ways. And here we are discussing this and I'm here going, be honest and yada, yada. But we all took planes to get there. So it's sort of, but it, in a sense, the film is about that impossible, like tightrope.
Yeah.
You know, of just kind of going like, it will, because it's for each to their own as to what that line is, you know, what's, and it's also circumstantial as well as to when something is okay to let slide for a minute for the kind of, you know, for the present benefit of the circumstance or whatever's going on. And then when it's not, and I don't really have a clinical answer for when that has been a sort of.
Sure.
Yeah, well, it's accurate, but it's something that I've thought about a lot since the job.
No, I don't need you to tell me you went home and you said this to your wife or whatever. That would be oversharing. But no, I get exactly what you're saying. I like the description of the movie as Tweed. You know, that's a good way of looking. I may steal that in the future. The intensity of it that you talked about, where I was trying to check in the production notes, was it a salt mine that some of it was filming, or where did you actually film those scenes kind of that look like a salt mine?
Yeah, well, in a salt mine.
Wow, end of question.
There we go. No, it was we filmed in two, actually. We had this the main one that you'll see when you watch the film. Most of those salty locations were in Sicily. Extraordinary place, which looks exactly like it does on screen. And I kind of thought it would be like a diamond mine or something where, you know, you chip away at rocks and there is salt within the rock, but everything, every surface that you sort of, the walls, the ceiling, the floor, it's just salt. It's I think it was a prehistoric dried up sea, basically. Okay. And there's a factory in there where they, you know, Kikkoman soy sauce, that's where all the salt comes from. And then we went to another one in Germany where there's an underground lake.
Okay.
And so for that particular lake, we went to Germany.
Okay, so real salt mines. Great. Now, I suppose whatever the intensity of it, it was waylaid by the fact that you had an Irish woman with you, which always makes things easier in the form of Brona Gallagher. So I'm assuming that helped, you know, just to have that wonderful presence who lights up any dark salt mine.
No, totally, totally. Brona's a force, man. She's wonderful. and like you know, and just amazing, an amazing person and presence to have on set, and probably, you know, the best singer out of the bunch as well.
Yeah, so, well, she has,
you know, form. We'd always look to Brona, you know?
She has form in that way, and that's not to dismiss the great performances of Tilda Swinton or anyone else or Michael Shannon or yourself, but I always Irish these things up. I hope you'll understand.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and you know I remember, like, you were in Captain Fantastic. Fathers and sons loom large in this one. Is that a topic, you know, fathers and daughters as well, but I guess, you know, you're talking about honesty and stuff like that. I presume that's a cathartic thing to do, to play a son with a complicated relationship with his father.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if that's how conscious that stuff was. I'm sure it may well be, but that said, I became a father soon before I played this character. So I think that's what I was sort of meaning, again, without going into the details of it, of like, suddenly having your own family, you want to just make the base. You kind of like, okay, well, I'm the base now, that this thing, we'll build this thing for the rest of our lives on the base.
Yeah.
And so I want the base to be solid. And that's kind of what the film's about, is a family that is not the base with which they've, you know, the point with which they went underground. Mm-hmm. And maybe even before that, within that marriage, was not a solid base.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just what that, the cracks that then appear over time. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know, for me, necessarily, it's not quite cathartic, but of course I think about that, you know, now having kids myself.
Yeah.
You reflect upon your own relationships with your parents and stuff. And yeah, so it's all in there. I mean, again, sometimes there'll be very conscious things that you'll be looking at, and other things which will be totally unconscious. And, you know, and it's a fictional story at the end of the day.
Yeah, of course.
Of course it resonates in ways personally.
Yeah. Kumar, I don't mean to spend so much time on fathers and sons, but I read this interesting thing about you this morning, because I was thinking of you as a child actor, and I have three of my own kids now, and how hard that might be or not. You know, I've spoken to plenty of people who are, you know, who started young and they swear by it. Other people found it tough. But I did read this thing about your dad crying in the airport when you headed off to Australia when you were 10. So, I mean, your memory of doing movies and TV when you were young, is it, do you look back on it now with your own kids going, God, that was strange? Or are you one of those people who think, I love the business, I always wanted to do it?
I don't know. God, I didn't know that was a known thing.
It's in The Guardian, so they never get anything wrong.
Oh, really? Okay, right. Well, I mean, I've got very fond memories of working as a child. And I think the greatest sort of luxury that came from it was unconscious at the time, which was that there was just no pressure. Mm-hmm. Like, my parents never put any pressure on me. I had all these experiences without kind of going, well, how's this job going to be received? About what's this going to mean for the next job? Is there, you know, you're not thinking about bills. You're not thinking about a career. You're not thinking about how choices are reflected upon by other people. It's a very present thing, which I think just kids are better at in general. Just you know, there's always, like, you know, the search for presence. And then these kids just are, you know, like, we're sort of hung up on how something might turn out or how it's been before. And, whereas I had all of these really fantastic experiences in these really top sets without really thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
In a way that, in some way, in good and bad ways, I think about it a lot now, you know, when I go, you know, what a set, you know, like how it works, how it runs, my place within it, all that kind of stuff, where I just didn't as a kid.
Yeah.
You just went and make believe for a wee while with a lovely group of people and then came home again. So, yeah. I think that's the best thing that I took. And with that, I've had so much experience, which I've kind of vital lessons learned without trying to learn them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. That's a very good way of putting it. Listen, Joshua Oppenheimer, he's a fascinating guy. And, you know, the art of killing, I presume you had seen that or you rewatched it, because there are maybe, and I've read the production notes about, he was trying to mine something in a similar space about, you know, bad people or people doing bad things that come back to haunt us and stuff. Were you a fan of that movie, The Art of Killing, or are you a fan of it? I mean, I haven't met many people who aren't, so it's kind of a silly question, but I wonder how big that was in your consciousness.
No, it was a massive thing. It was, I saw that film on my own at the cinema and was like blown away by certain scenes, particularly within it.
Yeah.
And so when the opportunity of reading this script came through, the three people who were involved in the making of it, or four people, sorry, at this stage was Josh as a writer-director, and his writing partner, Rasmus, as well. And then Tilda, Josh Schmidt, our composer, and Michelle Critchman, our director of photography. And so obviously Tilda, I've just respected and been in awe of her choices for her whole career. And so it's kind of nice, right, she's leading the cast. And then Misha shot this amazing, well, he's done so many films, but two particularly that I loved called Loveless and Leviathan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, then knowing that Josh had done The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, this is kind of like his chosen subject, denial and the ramifications of denial. And I kind of was just so thrilled at this subject and this musical in his hands, because there was definitely a real theatricality to that documentary, despite it being about very real and serious things. And again, it's his kind of through line, really, in the work, is this is what he's excavating and exploring. So it kind of gave me great faith in him leading this production.
Yeah. Let me ask you this in closing then. Here's a name drop for you, but I spoke to Robert De Niro a couple of weeks ago.
I just had
to get that in, right? But no, the thing is, when I asked him about Taxi Driver, and I said to him, I'm sorry, I'm sure this is, every time someone wants to talk to you about Taxi Driver, there are, even with someone who's had that long a career, there are certain movies. And in your case, you're not at De Niro levels yet, but you're well on the road, right? It seems to me, because the last time I spoke to you, I asked you about 1917. And I don't want to ask you about it again, because I was thinking, I'm not going to ask him about that again. But it's funny. Are you surprised by the life that film continues to have? Because even a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Adolescence on this show, and people were talking about the one shot, the one take, and 1917 was evoked. Here we are, it's been out 6 years, and it seems to me it comes up every time people like me talk to you. Is that a blessing or a curse?
Oh, no, it's a wonderful thing. Like, that film means so much to me, in life and work. There's so much came from that film and the experience of making it that, I feel so grateful for that experience. And, I've got no qualms about, talking about it. And it's a lovely thing to be part of something that's, in a sense, stands the test of time. And, of course, that said, on top of that, you want to keep moving on from that and keep going. But if it means stuff to other people, then that's a lovely thing. That's why you do the work. So it's all good.
And if I'm not mistaken, finally, in that same Guardian article, if I'm Garlican. Not remember, yeah, there we go. There's my new paper. If I'm not misremembering
this, Garlican Herd magazine.
Yeah, if I'm not misremembering this, you also met your now wife on that movie, right?
I was trying to allude to that was the life stuff that came from it. Yeah. It's so dear to my heart, that film, because. Yeah. Yeah, but for all the biggest reasons outside of work, it's everything, It's everything.
Wonderful. Well, listen, The End is a fascinating, beguiling watch, and you are fantastic in it. So continued success in anything that you do, and lovely to talk to you again, George.
And you, and thanks so much for, for having me on and talking about the film.
My pleasure. George Mackay there, talking to me about his career, meeting his wife on the set of 1917, and, of course, the new movie, The End, by Joshua Oppenheimer, which, as I say, is kind of dividing critics, but it is a wild, wild ride, and one of those movies that kind of awakes you from your slumber of the regular movies you watch, because it's this kind of apocalyptic drama that's also a musical, a very strange, intriguing film that is in cinemas, most importantly, from this Friday, the 28th of March. That is it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Farty is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. We'll do it all again next week. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you next week.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.